Three, two, one. Okay. So today we're going to be doing a podcast, which is going to be known as the
Litty Report, starting our world tour tomorrow, 3/4/2019.
All right. Now, my name is Matt Hills, and I'm going to be discussing a lot of different things about the play Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead by Tom Stoppard. Joining me to my right is
Migno Franco.
And to my left is
Patrick Kelly.
And we're going to kind of be going back and forth between what we see in this play, how it's different from the other play that we reviewed as a class earlier in the year, which was Waiting for Godot. And we're going to see how they're different, see how they're similar, and see how that all changes our different perspectives on society as a whole, ourselves, theater, etc. So I think Migno would be a good one of us to start off talking about it. What do you see in it?
All right, so we will essentially begin by talking about the existentialism element in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
Wait, don't you want to try to do the introduction?
Right. Before we actually begin, we would actually like to shout out a few people, a few places. We have Titus's Instagram page. He's a great photographer. He needs all the support that he can get. He wants to make a living out of it, which is fantastic. Mikey's SoundCloud, he's dropping straight fire these past few songs, and we believe that he should get all the love that he can get. We are also sponsored by Canes, Deku, and Aldi. Use code HILLSY to get 20% off your next purchase. And please do not hesitate, if you have a dollar to spare, to donate to our Patreon in order to get exclusive behind-the-scenes audio and first updates on our daily uploads.
Okay, so really we have to first start off with kind of giving an introduction on these two plays, and well, not really these two plays, but just the one play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, because it is a long play, there's a lot covered in it. We're going to give a pretty short description of it, and then we're going to kind of flesh it out as we go along, where we compare and contrast it, and really delve deeper into it. So, starting off with the play, what happens?
Absolutely. When the play opens up, we are basically introduced to our two main protagonists, as you call them, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. You may know them as minor characters, side characters from the main play Hamlet, but in this time they have their own little story, sort of showing the backstory of how they get introduced into the events of Elsinore and what their moral compass is like. So they are obviously summoned for. It doesn't explicitly say who it is, but they are summoned to go to Elsinore and to essentially check up on Hamlet, to see how he's doing, what's the source behind his madness. In this journey of theirs, they find a coin, which surprisingly will always land on heads every time it is flipped. Rosencrantz definitely takes to it as being some sort of miracle, while Guildenstern looks at it as a more philosophical way, maybe the fact that time stopped, or the fact that time is in a constant loop, and the fact that Rosencrantz keeps getting heads over and over again is just one event being repeated over and over.
Right. And there's a lot of other stuff that goes on later on in the play, like how they see those actors known as the tragedians. And I kind of felt that had to do with meta theater and meta text and all that. And we'll get into that later. But Pat, what did you see that went on a little bit after that, that kind of fleshed out the play for you a bit?
Following that, the tragedians essentially tell Rosencrantz and Guildenstern what all their shows are about. And they kind of play around with it, saying, oh, if you pay extra, you can join in. And Rosencrantz is the one with the coin, correct?
Correct.
Yes, he is. Just testing them.
Yeah.
He says, well, I'll make you a bet. Lands on heads. Rosencrantz wins. If it's tails, then the player who is part of the tragedians wins. Okay. Rosencrantz, thinking that he made some genius plan, flips the coin with his only heads coin. While doing that, Guildenstern is already starting to move away from the tragedians, wanting to continue on to Elsinore. And as Guildenstern is moving away, Rosencrantz revealed the flipped coins as tails. And that is really just a turning point in the play for me, where it shows that even when, like, something in life is expectingly just going your way, even though it's happened hundreds of times, or as in this case, 80-some, how many times did I flip the coin?
In the movie and in the play, they're both different. I believe in the play, it is around 80-something, but then right. In the movies, it brings it up to 100-some.
Right. Even though it's happening many, many times, things are still in place where it could change.
So, which, especially with the coin flip, this opens up to one of the existentialism elements that is very, that are prominently placed throughout this play. And we believe that through the coin flip, the playwright is saying that life is all a chance, as nothing in our lives is strictly determined. It brings up the argument that of the concept of nature versus nurture. In this play, it is clear that the main message is saying that we are born with nothing, and the things that do define our lives are the amount of merit that we accumulate during our lives. Also, in different situations, the fact that the outcome flip would change from heads to tails, as Patrick stated before, shows the way that as time goes along, different outcomes emerge that will be different from our earlier ones, shows the way that potentially because of peer pressure or overconfidence, as Rosencrantz was overconfident that the coin would land on heads, it shows the way that we can change the way that we are in order to become accepted by those who are higher on the societal ladder, which in this case would be Claudius the King.
Well, with the whole play and everyone who they come into contact with, sometimes kind of confuses and like messes up their identities throughout the play. And this is evident when, in this line, Stafford 78, as soon as we make a move, they'll come pouring in from every side, shouting obscure instructions, confusing us with ridiculous remarks, messing us about from here to breakfast, and getting our names wrong. Now, this isn't the only part through the play, but this is just one of the examples we found where their names are confused. And the confusion of their names and lessening of their identities breaks down who they are and what they mean throughout the play. It shows a sad perspective that they really didn't hold themselves up to such a high standard, as they don't really think much of it. They're just kind of sad. You know, they're depressed. They're like, oh, man, why aren't they getting my names right? I just want to be respected. I just want to be loved. I want to be taken care of by these people around me, right? And I mean, I'd be pretty sad if
you feel that. Name. If you think that that's what they're feeling, why did they confuse their own names?
Well, you say. Would you say that?
I would say that maybe it's them conforming to the Kingdom of Elsinore. If they're like mixing up their names, then why should they like come back and be like, no, this is my name? Maybe they're just like saying, okay, this is
gonna
be my name.
So it's like an influence on their personality.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this also proves the point that Hamlet, when he is confronting them about what their real reason is for visiting them, you know, he compares them to sponges, the fact that the king keeps them in there, his jaw like an ape, and them, like sponges, they just soak up all the saliva. So basically, like you all said, they're just
minor.
Yeah.
But it's in their own play. So we're seeing.
Which is ironic.
Which is ironic in a way, as we see them play out everybody else's own story through their own lens. Now, what about time? What do you think time's talked about at Mika?
So throughout the play, besides confusing their names constantly, they also don't really know how they got where they are and what their true purpose is. They know they were sent for, but they don't know exactly what they were sent for. Especially Rosencrantz, who is supposed to represent the action of man, is constantly asking about the time and where the sun is. This just shows just how out of place they are, and the way that is because of the way that they regard themselves. They don't feel a real connection to the world that they are living in. Personally, and this is my personal belief, is that they're really like robots. They only work when they are summoned by those higher than them. They do what they're assigned, And then they go back just around simply waiting, not doing anything productive with their lives, which really is in complete opposition to what true existentialists believe, which is that we should spend each valuable moment of our lives doing something that we want. And if we do that, it will help in giving our lives a stronger meaning. And to quote from the play directly, it is, if it is, and the sun is over there, for instance, that would be northerly. On the other side, if it's not morning and the sun is over there, that would still be northerly. To put it another way, if we came from down there and it is morning, the sun would be up there. And if it is actually over there and it's still morning, we must have come up there. And if that is southerly and the sun is really over there, then it's afternoon. However, if none of these is the case, then it ends.
I really saw that just as a complete breakdown of time and how we see it, right? I mean, if we didn't regard the sun as something very powerful to see the time move outside of our own perceptions of what time is and our own invented time and our own invented calendars, I feel like we really wouldn't have a sense of where everything's going outside of our own projections onto reality. Our own projections onto how we live.
Really, you're saying the sun is like a higher power to a time.
Well, the sun is really just, it's the representation, it's a physical representation that time is indeed passing to us.
I feel like time was created by man, though. Nothing really in nature describes time.
That may be true.
To a certain extent, I do agree with that, because you can see the time passing when you look at the trees. You know, you see the leaves fall, but then you also see flowers growing and overall spreading. So it all depends on the way you'd like to take it. But we do have one more element of existentialism that is present, which is Matt.
Not letting life pass you by too often. And if you're going to miss all of your opportunities throughout your lifetime, which through existentialism is said repeatedly, it is doomed to end. You will die. We all die. It's something that unites us. But in the end, you will die. Your life will come to an end. Now, overall, keep an open mind to all the opportunities that life presents you, is what this notion is. Never put all of your eggs in one basket, as you really can't be sure what life will throw at you, especially as chance was heavily emphasized in this play. It is ironic that both felt certain in their predicament simply by putting their faith in those who were powerful, such as the king. Now, Pat, what did you think about that? Putting the faith in the king.
Well, as we know as an audience, that King Claudius is obviously not someone to be trusted.
Right.
Because we know that
it's dramatic irony,
correct.
Yeah.
He killed his own brother, the king, ascended to the throne where Hamlet should have, and also married
Gertrude.
So yes, as Matt said, dramatic irony. We as an audience know that Claudius is not to be trusted, but how is anyone in the play supposed to know that? And I think that directly relates to life, because if we don't know all the facts, how are we supposed to know how to go through our own life?
Get at it.
Yes. Right. So we should always be looking for new knowledge that we come across. But along with that, that's like having the ability to trust it.
Mm-hmm.
Because anyone can put something on the internet. Anyone can tell you anything.
Yeah.
So if you put your trust into the wrong hands, just as Rosencrantz and Guildenstern put their trust into Claudius's hands, but then to some extent to Hamlet's as well, as they were moving to England with him, they were backstabbed by him and where they paid the ultimate consequence with their life with it.
Right. And even if they do keep going on this path with their closed mind and their kind of tunnel vision, they would have noticed it if they had an open mind, and they could have gone down the right path at the last minute, saving themselves from death, as we see, as from the audience perspective. Because of that, they could have actually led a better life and truly appreciate the things that they were given, as is seen in this quote on page 29 of the play. Well, I'll leave the choice to you. If there's anything to choose between them, and that was in 24, this is in 28, both of your 29. Both of your majesties might, by the sovereign power you have on us, put your dread pleasure and mourn to command, then to entreaty. End quote.
All right. So now we'll start to slowly begin looking into the similarities between both of the plays, both Waiting for Godot and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. Waiting for Godot, just a short summary, is essentially about two men, Gogo and Didi, who have been summoned by Godot. They are waiting for him. They're not moving from their place because they know that they are waiting. They're waiting for who, Matt? Roll credits. And because of that, there's some similarities, but also some differences between the two plays. As you can look at it, for example, one similarity is that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, they're waiting for their cue to enter into the story, because during their main story, they have the story of Hamlet, which was written by William Shakespeare in the past, in the background. So they're just simply waiting for that entrance. They're waiting for them to come on and to actually have much more of a presence than they had in Hamlet, correct?
One of the similarities that I really found right off the bat, which was pretty important, was how both of the plays start off in the middle of nowhere, as we see. And obviously, Waiting for Godot draws off of inspiration from The Wasteland. But since what Rosencrantz and Guildenstern draws off of Waiting for Godot, it could be said that it also draws off of The Wasteland. I mean, they are just out in the middle of nowhere. So it really kind of highlights how separated they are from the rest of society and their problems. But even though it does show that, they are still pretty connected, and it is a problem that most people struggle with throughout most of their lives. Additionally, from this, both of these characters are sent from a person of power. A higher-up power is who sends them to do something. For Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, that's the king, but Gogo and Didi, again, that is Godot. Additionally, something I thought that was really interesting was the changing of hats in Waiting for Godot. And the changing and the confusion of names in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern is a pretty big similarity in highlighting how, like, what would you say, meet the
yeah, so
changes, identity changes, right?
Right. It might have not been very clear in the stage directions, but in the movie for Waiting for Godot, you could definitely see the way that as they were exchanging hats and trying each of them on, none of them were bothered by the different hats they were wearing. In a way, it was as if they were accepting the fact that they could also be identified as the other person, which is the same as Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. As both of you have stated, they are comfortable with getting their names mixed up and not retaining who they truly are.
Right. I really just saw that as a breakdown character completely, not just on the character level, but on the personal level, on the societal level. And it shows that, to me, in the sense of monotony, that it's just something that we go along with the crowd, and it's not something we handle alone, it's something we all kind of go with together, in a way.
And since, of course, we're talking about Waiting for Godot, and the similarities between that and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, we cannot forget to talk about waiting. So in Beckett's play, the playwright for Waiting for Godot, is about the uncertainty and frustration felt by Didi and Godot in their indeterminable waiting in limitless time, while Stoppard is about the uncertainty felt by Rosencrantz and Guildenstern in trying to understand the origin and meaning of events, which they come to realize are carrying them to their deaths.
That just the titles of both of them really just immediately tell you what's about to happen. You feel me, Matt? What's that look for?
Yes, Pat, that's a pretty good comparison. I mean, if we're going to go off of that, I guess it is fair to say that both of the plays mention the title at some point at crucial moments. I mean, with Waiting for Godot, they're always asked, we're waiting for
Godot.
But then with And that's repeated quite a few times. I'm not sure how many. Maybe it's 5 or 6.
But a lot more than that.
It's a lot more than that. But with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, then obviously that line is pretty big, and that's only said once at the end by the ambassador to the royal court, who we know from Hamlet, and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern then are all dead except for Horatio. And while the ways that they repeat these titles are different from both the plays, that kind of leads into all the other differences between the two plays. And one of the ones that I found was, at least for me, I don't know about the two of you, but the most noticeable difference between the two of these plays is that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern find their Godot, which is Hamlet. Hamlet comes to them. He finds them.
Is that really what they're looking for? They were sent for to find what was wrong with Hamlet.
Yeah.
And they never truly figured that out. They couldn't know if Hamlet was mad or not.
Well, they were...
In the end, they were asking themselves, like, how did we get here? Oh, we were sent for. For what? They don't know. So did they... Could you find something that you don't know you're looking for?
That is very thought-provoking. And, you know, I don't think we have the answer to that quite at this moment, but I'm sure our audience members would love to
comment in down below. Tell us what you think.
Yep, subscribe, share, favorite, all that good stuff.
Yeah.
So another difference is that in Waiting for Godot, both Gogo and Didi, they say that there's nothing to be done, nothing ever happens. But in Stopper's play, a great deal happens very rapidly. While we do have a lot of moments where we just have Rosencrantz and Guildenstern wait around, do their questions game as a sort of filler part before their main events, the play overall is moving very fast. They are sent for, they go through the forest, they reach Elsinore, they meet the players, they meet Hamlet, they meet the king, then they have their conflicts, they find out Polonius is dead, and then they, of course, are sent on the boat to London, which this sort of proves Patty's point that they really don't remember at the end, like, what they were sent for, since everything happens so fast. And it could be argued that because of the fact that they don't put that much emotion or sentiment in what they are doing, they don't consider it a value, so they don't remember it.
Right. And well, it is a similarity that's not But next, I was kind of wondering about what the two of you think about the play overall and what the author or playwright, not the author, is communicating to the audience. I mean, what are they saying to these people, the people who come from all different kinds of walks of life, how their views are different, how their class is different, all that stuff. How is that different? How are they communicating it to them? What is it that they are communicating? Whichever area you go, fight it out.
Right. I believe the playwright, which one do you want to talk about? For both? For
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Right. For Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, obviously the playwright wrote a great story. That's what I look for.
Really?
In stories is the plot theme.
Yes.
But underlying that will be a message in most, if not all, plays, books.
I keep going.
Which I, anyway, train of thought, left the station. Really what Beckett is trying to say, no, what Stoppard is saying in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
Yes.
Is that you don't want to be a... Don't laugh at me. Is that you don't want to be a secondary character in someone else's play. You really want to take things into your own hands and do things that are meant for you. And how... Just don't be waiting for your own Godot. Don't be waiting for anything to pass you by. Take the bull by the horns.
Yeah.
Take on life.
All right, Nathan, do you have anything else to add to that brilliant piece that Patrick gave us?
Absolutely. I would like to basically say, one of the main key messages would be like, do not rely on others for your own direction, really. Only you are the only one who can know in which direction you're supposed to head in. And if another person is tagging with you in that way, that's fine. But should you tag with them heading into a direction that you don't believe is going to lead to a happy ending, is going to lead to a dead end, I don't think you should stick with them. In this case, in both plays, but especially in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, pseudo couples are, the presence of pseudo couples is very important and very present. And, you know, it really does make you think, if Rosencrantz and Guildenstern were separated, let's say Rosencrantz, as the action of a man, would be able to put his head to something. You know, he'd think about it, and he wouldn't need to rely on Guildenstern to do something. And if the other way around, if Guildenstern would be able to acknowledge the fact that he himself can do something without telling Rosencrantz to do it, would they end up dead? Would they have a different ending? Would they have a happier ending? That remains to be seen. We don't know. What do you know, Matt? What do you know?
Well, what I know, what I feel that I know about this play and what the playwright is saying about it is that you shouldn't feel like you are someone in someone else's story, as you said. Only you can dictate your destiny, and really, you should never really have a chance. But also, that something I kind of felt was that the mind and the body do not really have to be different things. They can be one and the same, and that they do not have to be separate. Stoppard is saying that the mind of the body doesn't need to be so commanding over the physical state of the body. The mind by itself could act upon something, while the physical action could take the time to create its own coherent thoughts without the aid of the mind. As we see the characters die together, as Rosencrantz is the main character and Guildenstern is shown to be the thinker and planner of the two, ultimately, if one does not exist, then the other is irrelevant and simply cannot exist.
In this context, but as we brought up the point before, we're not sure if that would be different if they were to go their separate ways, which I will take the time to make the transition to our life applications. You know, we've talked about the main messages of the story, and how do we see us apply these messages to our lives? Matt, would you like to start this discussion off?
Yeah, definitely. I think that at least the mind and the body being separate, well, they are things that depend on each other and are physically set together. We oftentimes see in different forms of media that there's something that are not together. One cannot exist without the mind and the body. And if the opposite is true, then that can push us as a species and as a people a lot farther along. Yeah, and just a lot of the other different messages with how, like, to not be a part of someone else's story. I mean, thinking about that really helps you kind of wonder, like, whose story could you be a part of right now? I mean, it doesn't have to be in a huge way. Like, your life depends on it. Maybe you're part of your parents' story for a little while, and then you leave your house. And then you're part of your college's story. And then you leave the college. Then you're part of your job's story, your boss's story, your team that you work on. Maybe you're part of the branch of the military you serve. Maybe you're part of your teaching staff. You're part of that story. And really, not in a selfish way, in my opinion, it just shows you to be, really highlights you to be conscious of where you are in the whatever place that, the whatever place, whatever story you are a part of,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Mm-hmm. Pat, how do you see this play, the messages that it presents, apply to your own life?
Well, knowing that, going into my own life, I look for instances that I was a follower in someone else's story. I think back on my early years in Boy Scouts when I didn't know that much about anything really, and I kind of just followed along with the older scouts doing what they told me to do, learning from what they told me to do. And after serving my time, I guess you could say, as a follower, I learned that I learned that.
You could learn nothing.
All right. Welcome back to our podcast. Sorry for the brief interruption. We are back here with Patrick Kelly and Matt Hills. Yep. And to start off from where we left off, the question was, did you learn nothing in Boy Scouts? And Patrick?
Right. Summarizing what I said, if I did my time in Boy Scouts, saying is, Hamlet would have said, Denmark is a prison. Just as I said, hybrid is a prison. Maybe even some would say Boy Scouts is a prison. I don't know. How about you, Matt?
No,
it's
pretty good.
It's pretty good? All right, I agree. But anyway, as I was saying, what I was learning, I learned to be a leader in society. And I forgot how it related to the question from that.
How are you? Well, with existentialism, it's not concerned of you thinking about being a leader. It's about you being a leader. So how are you being a leader in your life right now?
So that makes me think back to, sorry to evade your question, I'll answer it later. But thinking back on the myth of syphilis.
Sisyphus.
Not syphilis.
You don't want syphilis.
No.
not good. Don't
get syphilis. There's a difference between thinking of doing something and doing it.
Yeah.
Every day I could think, oh, I'm going to
be a politician.
Lead in this way.
Yeah.
Whether it's completely different in me going through with and actually doing it. And I think that's shown in the play Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, because they're thinking about, oh, they can help Hamlet by doing this. They can do this, do that. But they're only thinking about doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And in my life, I always thought about when I was growing up, for example, I was being a leader in, like, as a president of something, not just like a political party, but any organization. But now
president of the chess club?
Yeah, you know, chess club, maybe the water polo team, if you're so inclined. But I kind of saw being a leader, or I'm seeing it now, is showing a good example to my siblings on how to be good to each other, to be kind to each other. Being a good example on in theater and how to, like,
have your lines memorized.
Have your lines memorized, definitely. And how to be a good student in the class.
Don't get false and angry.
How to keep your teachers happy and how to get your assignments in on time are definitely the areas where I am a leader in my own life, which differs from what I saw and what I thought of it as throughout most of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Meekna, what do you think? What have you learned from these pieces that the author is telling to us?
So definitely
playwright.
Hey,
watch it with authors.
Yeah.
So definitely one of the quotes that stuck with me was right at the end when, spoiler alert, both of them were about to hang themselves, hence the title, They Are Dead.
They die.
They do die, unfortunately, Matt. I'm very sorry. I'm hoping there's going to be a movie for you to watch, and hint, there is. Okay. But,
you want to watch a movie. Who's going to want to read a play?
Yeah, right.
Anyways, Guildenstern was saying how along the way, they might have missed an exit, missed a road to take them away from the predicament that they were in now. And I really tried to apply it to my life. I view it as I tried to keep an open mind, to base all my decisions not around chance, but around results. I tried to, especially in high school, I tried to take the hardest route. I don't want to leave any regret behind. I want to push myself. I want to challenge myself as a way to improve myself, both as a person, as a student, and to overall learn new things from all of those, such as you, Matt, such as you, Patrick, who are on this journey with me together. And I can definitely say that I've learned a lot of positive things from you guys. So thank you. Yeah. And I believe if Rosencrantz and Guildenstern would have been open to maybe Hamlet, to see the way that he reacted, maybe to themselves and not just be willing servants of the king, maybe things would have turned differently for them too.
We're back in the time, do you think they had a choice to serve the king?
Well, they definitely were not poor. I know that for sure. They were definitely wealthier than Horatio, which had a bit more privilege since he was considered Hamlet's friend, but so were Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. So if Hamlet kept respecting them for who they were, I'm sure that he would have pardoned them from executing the king's orders and they would have been just a power team.
It's freezing. I don't think Hamlet really had that much power, because
I feel like the king would have just overruled him. He would have seen the prince.
Well, to disagree with you on that, it does state that pretty early on, people outside of Elsinore, they would revolt against the fact that Claudius was king. Hamlet was definitely a lot more popular. He was rightfully king, first of all, and he was just overall more popular with the people. The only reason that Claudius stayed in power is because he used the false threat of war against Norway and Fortinbras, and you know, people sort of became frightened about that. And since Claudius was in the throne at the moment, they just decided to just, you know, let's leave it to him. I'm sure he'll make the right decisions to keep us safe, because that's our main concern right now.
So I think we said a lot of what we need to say, and I think that's probably a good time to start wrapping it up. Don't you guys think?
I do agree.
Anything else about the
playwrights.
Playwrights.
Playwrights. The playwrights idea. So we're going to conclude this podcast now to kind of wrap everything we set up into one final stroke. There were, as made the
four existential elements that were present throughout this play. They were the presence of the coin flip, the lessening of their identities, getting their names confused and accepting their names confused, the forgetfulness of the time and the position of the sun, and the fact that not letting life pass you too often, the whole concept of time moving forward and life ending, but how will you choose to live your life?
Mm-hmm. And just to conclude, the similarity parts, we both placed on out of the middle of nowhere in the wilderness. Both sets of characters were sent for by some kind of higher power. Both plays feature like a change of identities, such as the changing of hats and waiting for Godot, and changing and confusion of names in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead. And additionally, is the uncertainty that both of them feel about how their lives are going and how the road forward for them is going to continue on. Now, additionally, the final uncertainties that we're going to recap are the most noticeable difference between the two is that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern find their Godot, who is Hamlet. The waiting is different between the two plays. Gogo and Didi stay, while Rosencrantz and Guildenstern do things for other people. And Beckett's characters face
Interminable. So never-ending waiting.
Right, never-ending waiting. Okay. And nothing can be done, nothing ever happens. Are the cries of Didi and Gogo, but in Stopford's play, a lot happens since there's still a bigger plot going on around them. And finally, that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are convinced that they have seized control of their lives and has swept them to their deaths. They do not feel, like Gogo and Didi, that they have been abandoned, but that they have been deceived by some kind of attention towards them.
Well, as you say, they don't feel abandoned. If I were to leave you with the security of England by backstabbing you, wouldn't you feel abandoned by me?
I probably would, yeah.
All right. And then the overall messages of the play, the fact that the whole theme of meaningless of life and the way that the playwright Stoppard actually puts the accentuation on the fact that as long as you do something with your life and that whatever you do through each minute of it is valuable, then your life does begin to have meaning. The fact that you really should become your own main character in your life. You shouldn't let yourself follow somebody else in guiding you through your life, making all the decisions for you, because he is empowering in the fact that he wants people, and especially his readers, to take charge, to grab hold of their destinies, and to change them however they would like. And lastly, the fact that maybe, potentially, through the use of the pseudo-couples, that it's actually having the mind and the physical action of the body being separate are what eventually leads to damnation. As if they were one, problems might have not occurred as frequent, and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern would have not met the end that they met.
Discussing many different things about Stopford, thank you, Patrick, for reminding me what a playwright is and what a writer is in the first place. And that's going to be it today, guys. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.